Essay Andre's Arctic Balloon Expedition of 1897. From Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. n.wikipedia.org. Essay Andre's Arctic Balloon Expedition of 1897 was an ill-fated effort to reach the North Pole, in which all three expedition members perished. Essay Andre, 1854-97, the first Swedish balloonist, proposed a voyage by hydrogen balloon from Svalbard to either Russia or Canada, which was to pass, with luck, straight over the North Pole on the way. The scheme was received with patriotic enthusiasm in Sweden, a northern nation that had fallen behind in the race for the North Pole. Andre neglected many early signs of the dangers associated with his balloon plan. Being able to steer the balloon to some extent was essential for a safe journey, and there was plenty of evidence that the drag rope steering technique he had invented was ineffective, yet he staked the fate of the expedition on drag ropes. Worse, the polar balloon Orden, Eagle, was delivered directly to Svalbard from its manufacturer in Paris without being tested. When measurements showed it to be leaking more than expected, Andre refused to acknowledge the alarming implications of this. Most modern students of the expedition see Andre's optimism, faith in the power of technology, and disregard for the forces of nature as the main factors in the series of events that led to his death, and the deaths of his two companions, Nils Strindberg, 1872-97, and Knut Fraenkel, 1870-97. After Andre, Strindberg and Fraenkel lifted off from Svalbard in July 1897, the balloon lost hydrogen quickly and crashed on the pack ice after only 2 days. The explorers were unhurt but faced a grueling trek back south across the drifting ice cape. Inadequately clothed, equipped, and prepared, and shocked by the difficulty of the terrain, they did not make it to safety. As the Arctic winter closed in on them in October, the group ended up exhausted on the deserted Kvitoya, White Island, in Svalbard, and died there. For 33 years, the fate of the Andre expedition remained one of the unsolved riddles of the Arctic. The chance discovery in 1930 of the expedition's last camp created a media sensation in Sweden, where the dead men were mourned and idolized. Andre's motives have later been reevaluated, along with the role of the polar areas as the proving ground of masculinity and patriotism. An early example is Per Olof Sundman's fictionalized best-selling novel of 1967, The Flight of the Eagle, later filmed as Flight of the Eagle, which portrays Andre as weak and cynical, at the mercy of his sponsors and the media. The verdict on Andre by modern writers for virtually sacrificing the lives of his two younger companions varies in harshness, depending on whether he is seen as the manipulator or the victim of Swedish nationalist fervor around the turn of the 20th century. This article is in 10 parts. Part 1, Essay Andre's Scheme. Part 2, Promotion and Fundraising. Part 3, The 1896 Fiasco. Part 4, The 1897 Disaster. Part 5, Speculation and Recovery. 6, Cause of Deaths. 7, Legacy. 8, 9, and 10 are notes, references, and external links, which will not be read. Part 1, Essay Andre's Scheme. The second half of the 19th century has often been called the heroic age of polar exploration. The inhospitable and dangerous Arctic and Antarctic regions spoke powerfully to the imagination of the age, not as lands with their own ecologies and cultures, but as challenges to technological ingenuity and manly daring. The Swede Essay Andre shared these enthusiasms, and proposed a plan for letting the wind propel a hydrogen balloon from Svalbard across the Arctic Sea to the Bering Strait to fetch up in Alaska, Canada, or Russia, and passing near or even right over the North Pole on the way. Andre was an engineer at the patent office in Stockholm, with a passion for ballooning. He bought his own balloon, the Svea, in 1893, and made 9 journeys with it, starting from Gothenburg or Stockholm, and traveling a combined distance of 1,500 kilometers, or 900 miles. In the prevailing westerly winds, the Svea flights had a strong tendency to carry him uncontrollably out to the Baltic Sea, and drag his basket perilously along the surface of the water, and or slam it into one of the many rocky islets in the Stockholm archipelago. On one occasion, he was blown clear across the Baltic to Finland. His longest trip was due east from Gothenburg, across the breadth of Sweden and out over the Baltic to Gotland. Even though he actually saw a lighthouse and heard breakers off Åland, he remained convinced that he was traveling over land and merely seeing lakes. During a couple of the Svea flights, Andre tested and tried out the drag rope steering technique that he had invented and wanted to use on his projected North Pole expedition. Drag ropes, which hang from the balloon basket and drag part of their length on the ground, are designed to counteract the tendency of lighter-than-air craft to travel at the same speed as the wind, a situation that makes steering by sails impossible. The friction of the ropes was intended to slow the balloon to the point where the sails would have an effect, beyond that of making the balloon rotate on its axis. Andre claimed that with the drag rope sails steering, his sphere had essentially become a dirigible, but this notion is rejected by modern balloonists. The Swedish Ballooning Association ascribes Andre's conviction entirely to wishful thinking, capricious winds, and the fact that much of the time Andre was inside clouds and had little idea where he was or which way he was moving. Moreover, his drag ropes would persistently snap, fall off, become entangled with each other, or get stuck to the ground, which could result in pulling the often low-flying balloon down into a dangerous bounce. No modern Andre researcher has expressed any faith in drag ropes as a balloon steering technique. Part 2. Promotion and Fundraising. The Arctic ambitions of the northern European nation of Sweden were still unrealized in the late 19th century, while neighboring and politically subordinate Norway was a world power in Arctic exploration through such pioneers as Fridtjof Nansen. The Swedish political and scientific elite were eager to see Sweden take the lead among the Scandinavian countries, which seemed her due, and Andre, a persuasive speaker and fundraiser, found it easy to gain support for his ideas. At a lecture in 1895 to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, Andre thrilled the audience of geographers and meteorologists. A polar exploration balloon, he explained, would need to fulfill four conditions. First, it must have enough lifting power to carry three people and all their scientific equipment, advanced cameras for aerial photography, provisions for 4 months, and ballast, altogether about 3,000 kilograms, or 3 metric tons, approximately 3.5 short tons. Two, it must retain the gas well enough to stay aloft for 30 days. Three, the hydrogen gas must be manufactured and the balloon filled at the Arctic launch site. Four, it must be at least somewhat steerable. Andre gave a glowingly optimistic account of the ease with which these requirements could be met. Larger balloons had been constructed in France, he claimed, and more airtight, too. Some French balloons had remained hydrogen-filled for over a year without appreciable loss of buoyancy. As for the hydrogen, filling the balloon at the launch site could easily be done with the help of mobile hydrogen manufacturing units. For the steering, he referred to his own drag rope experiments with the Svea, stating that a deviation of 27 degrees from the wind direction could be routinely achieved. Andre assured the audience that Arctic summer weather was uniquely suitable for ballooning. The midnight sun would enable observations round the clock, halving the voyage time required, and do away with all need for anchoring at night, which might otherwise be a dangerous business. Neither would the balloon's buoyancy be adversely affected by the cold of night. The drag rope steering technique was particularly well adapted for a region where the ground, consisting of ice, was, quote, low in friction and free of vegetation. The principal precipitation in the area posed no threat of weighing down the balloon. If, against expectation, some rain or snow did fall on the balloon, Andre argued, quote, precipitation at above zero temperatures will melt, and precipitation at below zero temperatures will blow off, for the balloon will be traveling more slowly than the wind. The audience was convinced by these arguments, so disconnected from the realities of the Arctic summer storms, fogs, high humidity, and ever-present threat of ice formation. The Academy approved Andre's expense calculation of 130,800 kroner in all, corresponding in today's money to just under $1 million, of which the single largest sum, 36,000 kroner, was for the balloon itself. With this endorsement, there was a rush to support his project, headed by King Oscar II, who personally distributed 30,000 kroner, and Alfred Nobel, the dynamite magnate and founder of the Nobel Prize. There was also considerable international interest, and the European and American newspaper-reading publics were curious about a project that seemed as modern and scientific as the books of contemporary author Jules Verne. The press fanned the interest with a wide range of predictions, from certain death for the explorers to a safe and comfortable, quote, guidance of the balloon, upgraded by the reporter to an airship, to the North Pole in a manner planned by the Parisian experts and Swedish scientists. In these days, the construction and guidance of airships have been improved greatly, wrote the Providence Journal, and it is supposed, both by the Parisian experts and by the Swedish scientists who have been assisting M. André, that the question of a sustained flight in this case will be very satisfactorily answered by the character of the balloon, by its careful guidance, and, providing it gets into a polar current of air, by the elements themselves. Faith in the experts and in science was common in the popular press, but with international attention came also for the first time informed criticism. André being Sweden's first balloonist, nobody at home had the requisite knowledge to second-guess him about buoyancy or drag ropes. But in Germany and France there were long ballooning traditions, and many far more experienced balloonists than André, several of whom expressed skepticism of his methods and inventions. However, just as with the Svea mishaps, all objections failed to dampen André's optimism. Eagerly followed by national and international media, he began negotiations with the well-known aeronaut and balloon builder Henri Lachambre in Paris, world capital of ballooning, and ordered a varnished three-layer silk balloon, 20.5 meters or 67 feet in diameter, from his workshop. The balloon, originally called Le Pôle Nord, French for the North Pole, was to be renamed Ornan, Swedish for the Eagle. Part 3. The 1896 Fiasco. For his 1896 attempt to launch the balloon, André had many eager volunteers to choose from. He picked an experienced Arctic meteorological researcher, Nils Gustav Ekholm, 1848-1923, formerly his boss during an 1882-83 geophysical expedition to Spitsbergen, and Nils Strindberg, 1872-97, a brilliant student who was doing original research in physics and chemistry. The main scientific purpose of the expedition was to map the area by means of aerial photography, and Strindberg was both a devoted amateur photographer and a skilled constructor of advanced cameras. This was a team with many useful scientific and technical skills, but lacking any particular physical prowess or training for survival under extreme conditions. All three were indoor types, and only one of them, Strindberg, was young. André expected a sedentary voyage in a balloon basket, and strength and survival skills were far down on the list. Modern writers all agree that André's North Pole scheme was unrealistic. He relied on the winds blowing more or less in the direction that he wanted to go, on being able to fine-tune his direction with the drag ropes, on the balloon being sealed tight enough to stay airborne for 30 days, and on no ice or snow sticking to the balloon to weigh it down. In the attempt of 1896, the wind immediately refuted his optimism by blowing steadily from the north, straight at the balloon hangar in Danskoya, until the expedition had to pack up, let the hydrogen out of the balloon, and go home. It is now known that northerly winds are to be expected at Danskoya, but in the late 19th century, information on Arctic airflow and precipitation existed only as contested academic hypotheses. Even Ekholm, an Arctic climate researcher, had no objection to André's theory of where the wind was likely to take them. The observational data simply did not exist. On the other hand, Ekholm was critical of the balloon's ability to retain hydrogen from his own measurements. Ekholm's buoyancy checks in the summer of 1896, during the process of producing the hydrogen and pumping it into the balloon, convinced him that the balloon leaked too much ever to reach the pole, let alone to go on to Russia or Canada. The worst leakage came from the approximately 8 million tiny stitching holes along the seams, which no amount of glued-on strips of silk or applications of special secret formula varnish seemed to seal. The balloon was losing 68 kilograms, or 150 pounds, of lift force a day, and taking into account its heavy load, Ekholm estimated that it would be able to stay airborne for 17 days at most, not 30. When it was time to go home, he warned André that he himself would not be on board for the next attempt, scheduled for summer 1897, unless a stronger, better-sealed balloon was bought. André resisted Ekholm's criticisms to the point of deception. On the boat back from Svalbard, Ekholm learned from the chief engineer of the hydrogen plant the explanation of some anomalies he had noticed in his measurements. André had from time to time secretly ordered extra topping up of the hydrogen in the balloon. André's motives for such self-destructive behavior are not known. Several modern writers, following Sundman's André portrait in the semi-documentary novel The Flight of the Eagle, 1967, have speculated that André had by this time become the prisoner of his own successful funding campaign. The sponsors and the media followed every delay and reported on every setback, and were clamoring for results. Andreas Strindberg and Ekholm had been seen off by cheering crowds in Stockholm and Gothenburg, and now all the expectations were coming to nothing with the long wait for southerly winds at Danskoya. Especially pointed was the contrast between Nansen's simultaneous return, covered in polar glory from his daring yet well-planned expedition on the ship Fram, and Andre's failure even to launch his own much-hyped conveyance. Andre, theorizes Sundman, could not at this point face letting the press relay the message that besides not knowing which way the wind would blow, he had also miscalculated in ordering the balloon and would like another one. After the 1896 launch was called off, enthusiasm for joining the expedition for a second attempt in 1897 did not run quite so high. There were still candidates, however, and Andre picked out the 27-year-old engineer Knut Frenkel to replace Ekholm. Frenkel was a civil engineer from the north of Sweden, an athlete and fond of long mountain hikes. He was enrolled specifically to take over Ekholm's meteorological observations, and without any of Ekholm's theoretical and scientific knowledge, nevertheless handled his task effectively. His meteorological journal has allowed the movements of the three men during their last few months to be reconstructed with considerable exactness. Part 4. The 1897 Disaster. 4.1. Launch, Flight, and Landing. Returning to Danskoya in the summer of 1897, the expedition found that the balloon hangar built the year before had weathered the winter storms well. The winds were more favorable too, and Andre's leadership was more absolute, now that the critical Ekholm, an authority in his field and older than Andre, had been replaced by the 27-year-old enthusiast Knut Frenkel. On July 11th, in a steady wind from the southwest, the top of the plank hangar was dismantled. The three explorers climbed into the already heavy basket, and Andre dictated one last-minute telegram to King Oscar and another to the paper Aftonbladet, holder of press rights to the expedition. The large support team cut away the last ropes holding the balloon, and it rose slowly. Moving out over the water at low height, it was pulled so far down by the friction of several hundred-meter-long drag ropes against the ground as to dip the basket into the water. The friction also twisted the ropes round, detaching them from their screw holds. These holds were a new safety feature that Andre had reluctantly been persuaded to add, whereby ropes that got caught in the ground could be more easily dropped. Now most of them unscrewed at once, and 530 kilograms, 1,170 pounds, of rope were lost, while the three explorers could simultaneously be seen to dump 210 kilograms of sand overboard to get the basket clear of the water. 740 kilograms, 1,630 pounds, of essential weight was thus lost in the first few minutes. Before it was well clear of the launch site, the Eagle had turned from a supposedly steerable craft into an ordinary hydrogen balloon with a few ropes hanging from it, at the mercy of the wind, with no ability to aim at any particular goal, and too little ballast. Lightened, it rose to 700 meters, 2,300 feet, a quite unforeseen height in any of the calculations made, where the lower air pressure made the hydrogen escape all the faster through the 8 million little holes. The balloon had two means of communication with the outside world, buoys and homing pigeons. The buoys, steel cylinders encased in cork, were intended to be dropped from the balloon into the water or onto the ice, to be carried to civilization by the currents. Only two buoy messages have ever been found. One was dispatched by Andre on July 11th, a few hours after takeoff, and reads, "Our journey goes well so far. We sail at an altitude of about 250 meters, at first north 10 degrees east, but later north 45 degrees east. Weather delightful, spirits high." The second had been dropped an hour later, and gave the height as 600 meters. Aftonbladet had supplied the pigeons, bred in northern Norway, with the optimistic hope that they would manage to return there, and their message cylinders contained pre-printed instructions in Norwegian, asking the finder to pass the messages on to the newspaper's address in Stockholm. Andre released at least four pigeons, but only one was ever retrieved, by a Norwegian steamer where the pigeon had alighted and been promptly shot. Its message is dated July 13th, and gives the travel direction at that point as east by 10 degrees south, adding, "All well on board." Lundstrom and others note that all three messages fail to mention the accident at takeoff, or the increasingly desperate situation which was being detailed in Andre's main diary. The balloon was out of equilibrium, sailing much too high, and thereby losing hydrogen at a faster rate than even Nils Ekholm had feared, then repeatedly threatening to crash on the ice. It was weighed down by being rain-soaked, dripping wet, writes Andre in the diary, and all the sand and some of the payload were being thrown overboard to keep it airborne. Free flight lasted for 10 hours and 29 minutes, and was followed by another 41 hours of bumpy ride, with frequent ground contact before the inevitable final crash. The Eagle thus traveled for 2 days and 3.5 hours altogether, during which time, according to Andre, nobody on board got any sleep. The definitive landing appears to have been gentle. Everybody was unhurt, including the homing pigeons in their wicker cages, and all the equipment was undamaged, even the delicate optical instruments and Strindberg's two cameras. 4.2. On foot, on the ice. From the moment they were grounded, Strindberg's highly specialized cartographic camera, which had been brought to map the region from the air, became instead a means of recording daily life in the ice scape and the constant danger and drudgery of the trek. Strindberg took about 200 photos with his 7-kilogram, 15-pound camera over the course of 3 months they spent on the ice pack, one of the most famous being his picture of Andre and Frankel contemplating the fallen eagle. Andre and Frankel also kept meticulous records of their experiments and geographical positions, Andre in his main diary, Frankel in his meteorological journal. Strindberg's own stenographic diary was much more personal in content and included his own general reflections on the expedition, as well as several messages to his fiancée Anna. The Eagle had been stocked with safety equipment such as guns, snowshoes, sleds, skis, a tent, a small boat in the form of a bundle of bent sticks to be assembled and covered with balloon silk, most of it stored not in the basket, but in the storage space arranged above the balloon ring. It had not been put together with great care, nor with any thought of the indigenous people's techniques for adapting to the extreme environment. In this, Andre contrasted not only with later, but also with many earlier explorers. Sven Lundström points to the agonizing extra efforts that became necessary simply because the sleds Andre had designed, of a rigid construction which owed nothing to Inuit sleds, were so impractical for the difficult terrain, dreadful terrain, Andre calls it, with its channels separating the ice floes, high ridges, and partially iced over melt ponds. Their clothes did not include furs, but consisted of wooden coats and trousers plus oilskins. The oilskins were worn, but the explorers seemed always to be damp or wet from the half-frozen pools of water on the ice and the typically foggy, humid Arctic summer air, and always preoccupied with drying their clothes, mainly by wearing them. Danger was everywhere, as it would have meant certain death to lose the provisions lashed to one of the inconvenient sleds into one of the many channels that had to be laboriously crossed. Before starting the march over the dreadful terrain, the three men spent a week at a tent in the crash site, packing up and making decisions about what and how much to bring, and where to go. The far-off North Pole was not mentioned as an option. The choice lay between two deposits of food and ammunition laid down for their safety, one at Cape Flora in Franz Josef Land, and one at Seven Islands in Svalbard. Thinking the distances to each about equal, from the faulty maps of the day, they decided to try for the bigger depot at Cape Flora. Strindberg took more pictures during this week than he would at any other later point, including 12 frames that make up a 360-degree panorama of the crash site. The balloon had carried a lot of food, of a kind more adapted for a balloon voyage than for travels on foot. Andre had reasoned that they might as well throw excess food overboard as sand, if losing weight was necessary, and if it was not, the food would serve if wintering in the Arctic desert did after all become an issue. There was therefore less ballast and large amounts of heavy-type provisions, 767 kilograms, or 1,690 pounds altogether, including 200 liters of water and some crates of champagne, port, beer, etc., donated by sponsors and or manufacturers. There was also lemon juice, though not as much of this precaution against scurvy as other polar explorers usually thought necessary. Most of the food was in the form of cans of pemmican, meat, sausages, cheese, and condensed milk. Some of it had in fact been thrown overboard. The three men took most of the rest with them on leaving the crash site, along with other necessities such as guns, tent, ammunition, and cooking utensils, making a load on each sled of more than 200 kilograms, 440 pounds. This was not realistic, as it broke the sleds and wore out the men, and after 1 week a big pile of food and non-essential equipment was left behind, bringing the loads down to 130 kilograms per sled. It became then more necessary than ever to hunt for food. Seals, walruses, and especially polar bears were shot and eaten throughout the march. Starting out for Franz Josef Land, the southeast, on July 22nd, they soon found that their struggle across the ice with its two-story high ridges was hardly bringing the goal any nearer. The drift of the ice was in the opposite direction, moving them backwards. On August 4th, they decided, after a long discussion, to aim for seven islands in the southwest instead, hoping to reach the depot there after a 6 to 7 week march, with the help of the current. The terrain in that direction was mostly extremely difficult, sometimes necessitating a crawl on all fours, but there was occasional relief in the form of open water. The little boat, not designed by Andre, was apparently a functional and safe conveyance, and smooth, flat ice flows. Paradise, wrote Andre. Large, even ice flows with pools of sweet drinking water and here and there a tender-fleshed young polar bear. Exclamation point included in the original. They made fair apparent headway, but the wind turned almost as soon as they did, and they were again being moved backwards, away from seven islands. The wind varied between southwest and northwest over the coming weeks, which they tried in vain to overcome by turning their own course more and more westward, but it was becoming clear that seven islands was out of their reach. On September 12th, the explorers resigned themselves to wintering on the ice, and camped on a large floe, letting the ice take them where it would, which, writes Kjellstrom, it really had been doing all along. Drifting rapidly due south towards Kvitøya, they hurriedly built a winter home on the floe against the increasing cold, with walls made of water-reinforced snow to Strindberg's design. Observing the rapidity of their drift, Andre recorded his hopes that they might get far enough south to feed themselves entirely from the sea. However, the floe began to break up directly under the hut on October 2nd, from the stresses of pressing against Kvitøya, and they were forced to bring their stores onto the island itself, which took a couple of days. Morale remains good, reports Andre at the very end of the coherent part of his diary, which ends with the sentence, "With such comrades as these, one ought to be able to manage under practically any circumstances whatsoever." It is believed, on the basis of the incoherent and badly damaged last pages of Andre's diary, that the three men were all dead within a few days of moving onto the island.